We are talking about Christian ethics, and we're going to begin a sub-series in that longer series on work and wealth. And I determine work and wealth as opposed to poverty, because the ethics have to do not with poverty. They have to do with our ethics of work, our understanding of the biblical teaching on the nature of work and on wealth, and what we do with it, how we make it, what we do with it. And I apologize for not having the notes up. I thought I'd posted them up, but Joe tells me they weren't up, and I must have neglected to do that. But I'll do that this afternoon so that you'll have them.
And
as the providence of God would have it, I pretty much changed this whole lesson this morning. You would have posted the notes, they would have had it. What I want to do is draw attention to John chapter 12 and a rather familiar story that I think probably is an appropriate way to begin a class on ethics and specifically work and wealth. John chapter 12, beginning at verse 1. Jesus, therefore, 6 days before the Passover, came to Bethany, where Lazarus was, whom Jesus had raised from the dead. So they made him a supper there, and Martha was serving. But Lazarus was one of those reclining at the table with him. Mary, therefore, took a pound of very costly perfume of pure nard, and anointed the feet of Jesus, and wiped his feet with her hair. And the house was filled with the fragrance of the perfume. But Judas Iscariot, one of his disciples, who was intending to betray him, said, Why was this perfume not sold for 300 denarii and given to poor people? Now, he said this not because he was concerned about the poor, but because he was a thief. And as he had the money box, he used to pilfer what was put into it. Jesus therefore said, "Let her alone, in order that she may keep it for the day of my burial. For the poor you always have with you, but you do not always have me." And that last phrase is the one that most people remember. Even people who aren't Christians, who have never read the Bible, they identify this statement as a part of the Bible. Now, there are a couple comments that I can't help but make about this story before we get to the point I want to make. The first thing that strikes me here is this. Those who claim that Jesus was simply a wise prophet of Israel, a good teacher, have got to explain how anyone could be a prophet of Israel and basically accept the kind of worship that Jesus accepts here. That would have been blasphemous. The fact that Jesus accepts worship in terms of this act is a powerful statement about the way in which Jesus saw himself. We can argue about how clearly Jesus basically claims to be the Son of God or to be equal with God, but there are passages like this that strongly suggest that when you look at Jesus' ministry, he cannot be dismissed just as a good teacher. If this record is correct, this is not a statement of a good teacher in Israel. A good teacher, a prophet, could not say this. And I think that is the first thing I want to say. But really, the point I want us to gather from this story is this. Material wealth can be used in the service of three things, and we have them all illustrated in this story. First is in service of self, self-gratification. We see that in Judas. Judas basically hated to see all that costly perfume being wasted on Jesus' feet when he saw it going into the treasury, potentially, and then into his pocket as a result. Now, I know there's no one else after Judas that thought that way, but nonetheless, he represents a way of looking at it, hypothetically. Others look at it more idealistically. The disciples certainly were this way. This is the point Judas was appealing to. This could help others. Social responsibility. There are many people who need this money. We could have given it to them to help them out. And the last option is basically an act of worship to God, spiritual worship, where Jesus accepts this anointing for his burial, an act of generosity which makes no rational sense in light of the first two. But nonetheless, he accepts it and applauds it. And he says, basically, you're always going to have the poor. Now, that doesn't sound like the Jesus we'd like to know. It's almost as though he's saying you can't conquer poverty in a broken world. And of course, you know he's right on our soberer moments. But it just doesn't sound very politically correct. The point is this. The story stands as a challenge to all disciples of Jesus who reduce Christian faith to social ethics and personal fulfillment. And that, very frankly, is a lot of us. A lot of us would like to reduce religion generally, and Christianity in particular, to simply social ethics. And to the extent that Jesus' teaching supports social ethics, amen to Jesus. When he doesn't, then we dismiss him in some way as being irrelevant, or as the record not being accurate in terms of the real Jesus. And for many of us, Christianity is not just about social ethics, it's about our own fulfillment. We believe that the abundant life, which we allow the world to fill in the blanks in terms of what that consists of, is going to come to us if we simply obey Jesus and follow him. We're going to have a life where our ship comes in and a red carpet goes out, as I said over and over again, where things are going to go our way. Jesus is going to be a chaplain for the American dream. He's going to make our dreams come true. There are a lot of Christians who actually believe and teach that. This story challenges that. Outside the context of spiritual peace to the cross of Christ, the cross of Christ here is not just Jesus' cross, it's the cross we bear. It's the cross that links us with him in terms of our lifestyle. That comes first. And if there's anything that I'm taking away from this passage in the context of Christian ethics, it's this. We have got to start ethics by looking at Jesus first. The first observation I want to make. The ethics of work and wealth start with worshipful attention to Jesus rather than the poor. We don't start by looking at the poor. We're going to look at the poor today. But we start by looking at Jesus. Spiritual worship basically is the first commandment. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and mind. But it doesn't stop there. And your neighbor as yourself. There is a place for personal fulfillment. There is a place for social ethics, of course. But the first commandment is the first for a reason. It's not the second. And the second commandment, although it's like it, is the second commandment. They can't be separated. They are all one body. But the order here is significant. The important thing is this. The main thing is to keep the main thing the main thing. But that's the lesson. If you get this far and you fall asleep, you've got it. Now, if you want a text, just turn the volume down while we're going. The world has it upside down. The world basically says social responsibility or social ethics and self-gratification, self-fulfillment, really are the issues with religion and including Christianity. And to the extent that Jesus Christ's teaching support that, we applaud him. To the extent that it doesn't fit, we ignore him or explain him away in some way. The kingdom's perspective, and the perspective I believe that is suggested by this story, is that spiritual worship is where ethics starts, where Christianity starts. If it doesn't start there, it doesn't start. Now, if it ends there, it ends. Because social responsibility and personal fulfillment are a part of what's entailed in the promises made to God's people. But we've got to be sure that we don't reverse this pyramid and look at the issue of wealth and work as being in service of ourselves and of our fellow man, as opposed to, or primarily in opposition to, our worship of Christ. Mother Teresa has it right. I don't agree with Mother Teresa on a lot of things. But when she gets it right, and I think this is an area where she understands and sees things that many of us as evangelical Protestants don't see.
When asked about her ministry as a social worker, she replied, and I've mentioned this quote before, "My ministry is not social work, it is worship. My care for the suffering is my love for Jesus." In other words, I'm not serving those who are dying, I'm serving Jesus, and I see Jesus in their faces. That theology is a Catholic theology, but more importantly, it's a Christian theology. It comes basically from a straightforward reading of the teaching of Jesus. The second observation I want to make is this. The poor are always with us and should not be ignored. Most of us are not numbered with the poor, materially at least. Statistically, we know that 50% of the world's population live on less than $2.50 a day. And that's the figure that is used to compare statistics internationally. A good portion of them live on less than $1.25 a day. And another 30% live on less than $10 per day. The rest of us live on a small slice of this pie. And yet we have the impression that we're kind of the norm. Most of us recognize there are poor people in the world, of course, but they represent a very small part of the pie. Not so. And very frankly, when I began studying this some time ago, I was shocked by how ignorant I was and how blind I was to the extent to which world poverty is a real problem, a phenomena that is all out of proportion to the image that I had. I assumed that I was basically in the middle of society, that half the people were poor and half the people were richer. The world basically revolved around me. Now, I suspect that most of us grew up assuming that our experience is normal, wherever we are. And in America, especially, that's going to be distorted. Of course, a lot of the greatest wealth is in Sub-Saharan Africa, mid-Africa, Southeast Asia, South Pacific, and Latin America. I like this one. The have-nots and the have-yots. The 85 richest people in the world own the same wealth as 3.5 billion poorest people. That is astonishing. 85 people control that much wealth. Well, the have-nots and the have-yots. In the U.S., if we were to divide the land by wealth in the U.S., 1% would own all of the West and the Midwest, most of it. 9% would own the East, 30% would own the Deep South, 20% would own the bottom part of Texas, and 40% would own a dot in Texas. That is amazing. Most of us don't realize this is the U.S., this is not the world. The challenge is to produce a more just distribution of goods and services without killing freedom and productivity. Now, Republicans love this part. They are very scared of this part. Most of us probably are Republicans. You're already getting nervous. Fasten your seatbelts. You're going to be more nervous when I get through. The biggest worry with concentrated wealth is that the 1% will buy themselves favor from government. And we know that because that's the way it has always worked. Power comes with wealth, and wealth uses that power to gain privileges and to continue to acquire and keep those privileges. I think it's important for us to note that the 40% in the red dot still have more than most of the people in the EU and the European Union, let alone the rest of the world. And that's something that in America we sometimes forget. The poor in America really aren't poor by world standards. But the problem, the real problem with the 40% in the red dot, the real poor in America, is that their lack of wealth is linked to dignity, access to goods and services, influence socially, and opportunity. It's not just that they don't have money. They don't have access to things that we assume everyone has access to, but really the keys to access to health care, in many cases, education, transportation, job opportunities, so forth and so on, is linked to privilege, and privilege linked to wealth. Let's just say, for example, getting a job. Oftentimes, it's easy for us who are wealthy by world standards, by U.S. standards in many cases, to say, people who basically aren't making it financially simply need to work harder and be wiser. And if they work, they can solve that problem. In many cases, of course, those are realities of foolishness and laziness that do come home to rest with the rich and the poor. But in reality, it's much more complex than that. If you have the privilege of going to an Ivy League school, Harvard, Princeton, Yale, Columbia, you're going to have a network of colleagues, both as professors and classmates, who are going to give you tremendous advantages in employment. No matter what the quality of your education was at that institution, the real value of going to Harvard is the people you meet, because they will give you the jobs that you and your children will have. The poor do not have access to that. And it's not because they don't have money, or it's not a matter of money, it's a matter of what money enables them to do. Yes?
Jim, I have no expertise on any of this, and not to take anything away from anything you're saying, but those two bottom statements kind of surprised me a little bit, and I wonder, I'm not sure what your source for that was, but I wonder if in accounting for these comparisons, you know, the services and things like that that the people in populations have access to often is not counted as part of their income, but they're covered by those, you know, those services, and it really is part of their wealth overall. And I've heard that kind of discussion.
Well, that's true too. But I think what I'm thinking of here, and this of course is not controversial. If you're familiar with the statistics, you can go on the internet and get this stuff all over. And I've tried to find challenges to this data. I haven't found. If you can find some, great. But wherever I go in terms of researching data, it all basically is in agreement. This is pretty much the way it is. The distribution of wealth, for example, is not debated or controversial. The implications can be more so. Yes?
Well, I think his point could be illustrated by the fact that about 30% of the land of the United States is owned by the government. So it's owned by all of us.
And the point is?
So it's hard to say that 40% would own that dot when that 40% owns 40% of the 30% of the land mass of the United States.
No, no, this has nothing to do with land mass. I'm just saying that if U.S. land were divided by U.S. wealth, I'm not suggesting that the 1% own this much land. They own this much of the wealth. This is just a chart, in a sense.
Land does represent wealth, though.
That's part of your wealth. My concern with this one, Jim, and I'm not an expert either, not really, but if you compare the note on the bottom left to the rest of the world and the EU, then you kind of, that access, and I agree, if you don't go to Harvard, then you're not going to have as... If you go to a community college, you'll have less access to those than you go to Harvard or Yale. But it's still more access, more possibilities than if you compare it to the EU or the rest of the world.
Yes.
Not making it right, but if you're going to make the one comparison, you need to make the other comparison
and all. Sure, sure.
Still, yeah.
Yes.
I'm sorry. I think there is a historic component that's missing in this picture. For the most part of human existence, humans have been at starvation level worldwide, and world population was controlled by the starvation, and it was remained the same. With the invention of fertilizers and modern medicine, the world population goes steep up, and people reproduce again to the level of starvation. That's the normal condition of the world. And so you have these... That's nobody's fault. That's simply the way the world is put together.
It's kind of like the poor you have with you always.
Pardon me?
It's kind of like the poor you have with you always.
That's actually a punchline to a joke in the Old Testament.
Yeah, right. The situation changed in modern times with fertilizer, basically.
Right, right.
So America and Canada produce food for the rest of the world, and we have the ethics that compels us to give this food to other people because we feel guilty that they are poor. But that's so once we see that, maybe we...
Next week we're going to look at... I'm going to make a short reference to two books. One by Ron Sider, Rich Christians in an Age of Hunger. How many have read the book? A few. Back in the 60s. Rich Christians in an Age of Hunger. The book was written to refute it. It was called Productive Christians in an Age of Guilt Manipulators. which is interesting. But it frames the debate in some respects. We'll get to that in this series. Researchers at Harvard and Duke, and this is a review of something that I've shown some of you before, conducted a survey some time ago where they were basically what they were trying to do is chart the distribution of financial wealth across the population of the United States and see what it would look like. And they took the quintiles, the 20% increments of U.S. population, and they started with what was viewed as the socialist vision or ideal. And as you would expect, it would mean that the wealth was distributed pretty equally across all quintiles of the population. The lower would have a little less than the upper, but by and large, it would be shared equally. When they were asked, what do you think America should look like, being a capitalistic country, not a socialist country, it was a chart something like this, where the wealth would be skewed in the direction of the upper 20%. In other words, there would be some people who would be much richer than others. There would be some poor people. Most of the wealth would be toward the upper scale. Then if they were asked the third question, where do you think it really is? And they made a graph that looked something like this. It's really disproportionately skewed in the direction of the upper 20%, or the wealthy. They have far more of the wealth. Well, the reality looks like this. It's skewed, but more dramatically than most of us would have ever imagined. The top 1% control 42% of the wealth. The top 20% control 93% of the wealth. The lower 20% have less than 1% of the wealth. And the middle 60% have between 6 and 7% of the wealth. This is net worth. To make matters even more stark, when we look at the average after-tax household income, according to the same quintiles, during the economic boom starting back in 1975 and working through to the present, we see something that oftentimes is not mentioned. Politicians and the media will talk about the 1%. They're talking basically about this group here, the upper 1%. The income has dramatically shifted in a positive direction for them. For everyone else, the top 20% have made a pretty good difference, but the lower quintiles, there hasn't been a great difference at all. And in some respects, it's even been a decline in the lowest quintile. This is something that most of us who are somewhere in here don't see or feel. And this is why, for example, there's still a lot of unrest in our country concerning the distribution of wealth. Don't misunderstand me. I'm going to quiet your fears. I'm not arguing for socialism. I'm not saying that the Christian ethic leads us to a socialistic solution to this problem. But I am saying that there is a problem here that comes, and it is seen in terms of the lack of equity in the distribution of wealth. Ideally, what we would like to see is more freedom, more encouragements and incentives to be entrepreneurial in creating wealth, but we'd also like to see it more justly distributed in the population. The top 10 highest paid CEOs in the United States each receive over $100 million last year, according to the survey of the Global Market Insight ratings.
In 2012, income for the highest paid of the CEOs, Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg, $2.3 billion in stock options, would be enough to pay the salaries of all 2,300 transit workers in the Bay Area, where Zuckerberg lives, for more than 16 years. Yet in the midst of a four-day strike that just ended, it was the transit workers who were denounced by the media and politicians as overpaid. Now, when people look at this kind of phenomena, you can understand why they're scratching their head and saying, what's going on here? Something is not working quite right. Poverty has a profile. The percentage of each group that is under the poverty level in the U.S. Dropped out of high school, 30% of dropouts are going to be in the poverty level eventually. Not a poverty level, below it. Single female with children, number two, 46%. From a poor home, 50%. Although that's the statistics there are somewhat obscure. These three things are the greatest indicators, researchers tell us, of whether a person's going to wind up on the poverty rolls or on the poverty level or below it. Dropping out of high school, single family with children, that is a breakdown of the family, and from a poor home. You grow up in a culture of poverty. You're used to that. You perpetuate it, so to speak. Now, this gives us a hint as to ethically what Christians can do or should do with respect to attacking the whole problem of poverty. That is, it's a matter of addressing education, the health of the family, and the culture of poverty. If we do anything, it's got to involve or should involve attention to those things. African Americans are disproportionately among the poor, as are Hispanics and Native Americans. Children under 18, they're usually in homes with one parent, and the elderly over 65. Oftentimes are numbered among the poor. Material poverty is indexed to a number of things. One, crime and social unrest. Disproportionately, criminal activity, social dysfunction are linked to poverty. Marriage and family dysfunction. Marriages break up in all strata of the income bracket, but in poor families, the stresses are greater. Marriages are more fragile. Families oftentimes do not stay together. And personal, physical, and emotional health. All these things are indexed to poverty. If we're concerned about any of those things, the issue of poverty and distribution of wealth becomes an issue. When you look at the New Testament teaching of Jesus and the apostles, I notice that he gives attention to everyone. But specifically, his attention given to the poor is noted as being distinct from the culture in which he grew up. The orphans and the widows, the brokenhearted, the materially poor, the sick and wounded, the Samaritan, the one who's outcast, the prisoner. And we ask the question of these groups, what do these targets of Christian ministry share in common? And I'm going to suggest that what they share in common is not necessarily or just material lack, but rather a hunger for justice, community that is belonging, and dignity. And this is why, when we understand poverty, we've got to understand it as being more than just stuff. Again, Mother Teresa. The poverty in the West is a different kind of poverty. It is the poverty of loneliness and spirituality. There is a hunger for love, as there is a hunger for God. And if any of you have had the opportunity to travel in the third world and see a real ghetto, Nairobi, Kenya, or Manila, you have perhaps been shocked, as I have, in seeing Christians there who have a level of joy, although they're living in a cardboard shack and their kids are playing in a sewer, a level of joy that is astonishing and hard to explain. And you recognize in most settings that poverty is more than just having stuff. It's having a culture that involves hope, a sense of dignity, a sense of belonging, a sense of... Yes?
This is just really to validate what you're saying, but many years ago I did mission trips to Haiti, and some of you may know that I worked for a pharmaceutical company, and people there make pretty decent money, and I always remember the contrast between walking from the hospital, from the residence to the hospital compound, and the people who would smile and say good morning, who had joy, who were happy, who were, they had nothing. And then walking to work, you know, leaving Sunday and walking to work Monday morning and coming down the hallway where people had their Mercedes and their expensive cars and seeing the misery on their faces, you know, they wouldn't make eye contact, they didn't say hello. And that's not to say that people there weren't nice, but it was always to me such a cultural shock of here we are, the have-nots who had joy and shared anything they had compared to the people who had everything.
Right, right. Yeah, that's been kind of the universal experience of people who have been in the third world for any length of time. The point is this. Poverty is about more than material needs. Material is important. You can't live by bread alone. You need bread to live, however, but not alone. The basics are something we have to have. But also poverty is social. Not connected to a supportive community or to social structures of power is important. Political, not free to affect change in our own situation. And spiritual, not empowered from within with hope, dignity, and a sense of purpose and meaning that comes from a relationship with God. When we have those things, it's amazing what we can endure materially. Jacqueline Novogratz, who has written an interesting article in Forbes magazine, she's basically promoting entrepreneurial capital investment in companies that address the issue of dignity and not just material prosperity. Says this: dignity is more important to the human spirit than material wealth. Now, again, she's starting with the assumption, and if you've got enough food to survive and shelter for your head, if you've got those basics, then it's surprising how powerful the issue of dignity kicks in. If you've got dignity, you can survive a lot of the other stuff. If you don't, then you never have enough. There's never enough to basically supply or make up for it. Observation number three. Messianic ministry is indexed to spiritual material poverty. You can't read the story of Jesus and not come away being struck by the fact that he was saturating himself with the poor. For you know the Lord Jesus Christ, that though he was rich, yet for our sake, or your sake, he became poor, so that we through his poverty might become rich. Now, sadly, a lot of people have read this and say, aha, Jesus was not rich, but he wants me to be rich. And they're thinking this in terms of material things. I mean, I want to say, wake up. Anyone who looks at the disciples would recognize that's not at all what Jesus had in mind. They did not die, basically, as wealthy fishermen. Jesus was conscious of his identification with the poor, conspicuous, and conscious of that as well, but conspicuous in terms of his identification. The Incarnation says that. Basically, he laid aside his glory and became poor with us. And he says to his disciples, have this attitude in yourself, which also is in Christ Jesus, that Paul is saying this, who though he existed in the form of God, did not regard equality with God, something that he held on to or grasped. But he emptied himself, taking the form of a bondservant and being made in the likeness of man. He humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on the cross.
the people he was drawn to were the poor. The choice of disciples were among the poor. The crucifixion was that of a poor person, of a criminal. Jesus' mission was not to a drone strike, but boots on the ground, is the way of putting it, in the language of the media today. Jesus revealed himself as one of the poor, reached out to the poor, renewed hope for the poor, recognized the value of the poor, recruited disciples from among the poor, required that they minister to the poor. And when I hear this, I say, yes, but. And the Spirit of Christ says, you need to spend more time on your yes and less time on your but.
Hoorah!
Just some practical take home with this. I find this very uncomfortable. But unfortunately, as a teacher, I don't have the privilege of telling you what's comfortable for me. I have the obligation and the responsibility to say what the scripture I think is saying. And I know many of you are saying, yes, but. And I would encourage you, and there's room for a yes, but. There's more to be said here. There will be more said in the coming weeks. But it's got to start here. It's got to start with Jesus first. Our addressing this issue starts with our eyes going to Jesus, not to the poor. And say, what does it mean to follow Jesus? And you can't escape the fact that this man indexed his ministry with poverty. Our problem is that our attempts to address the poverty issue are drone strikes. A care package. How many of us really know people who are poor? Really poor. How many of us even have stopped to listen and hear the story of people who are poor? I'm embarrassed. I have a hard time finding very many in my social circle. One of the things that I like about the direction the Chapel Hill Bible Church has taken in the last several years is intentional focusing on areas of relative poverty in our community. And not just giving money, but getting involved. Cece and I were privileged to have dinner with Louise Ruderbusch last week. How many of you know about Louise? Agape Quarter in inner city Durham. Louise basically is... Louise and I have crossways on a lot of things. But boy, I'll tell you, I can learn a lot from her. I mean, she has moved into the inner city of Durham and ministered to street kids in places where it's not safe, and she stayed there. And she's basically made a huge difference in people's lives. That's the kind of thing that just smells a lot like Jesus to me. I can remember in the early years of the Bible Church, we had an elder from Reba Place Fellowship come and speak to us. Reba Place Fellowship is a Christian commune in Evanston, Illinois, inner city Chicago, or a wealthy area of Chicago. This is an unusual commune. It's a commune made up of largely white-collar workers, professionals, people who, like doctors, lawyers, maybe engineers, the people who made good salaries. They had come together and they had decided to pool their considerable incomes together and live on the welfare level of the county. In other words, they used those statistics to be their budget as families. What they did, however, was pool their resources and distribute the excess to housing developments in the areas surrounding Evanston, minister to the poor in that community. But they still had enough to, because they were living communally, to share goods and services. And as a result, they lived really comfortably. They had a yacht. They had a photo lab with expensive, high-quality, high-end camera equipment. But not every family owned this. They all owned it together. How often do you need a 5D camera? How often do you need a sailboat? But the 200 families could share that and have a benefit of it and not the expense of it. Well, the point is, they found ways to through their decisions to minister to the poor, have a powerful effect on the city of Chicago. I've lost contact with Virgil Boat. Hey, do you remember Virgil when he was here? Hank's gone.
He didn't
go.
Does anyone else, was anyone else here when that happened? No one else. But I remember much of what he said. He said that when people were asked to join this commune, by the way, I'm not advocating a commune. And nor was he. He was saying, this is the way we've chosen to express our Christian faith. We're not basically selling it. It won't work in a lot of places. It takes special people to do this. He said, we asked the person to join us for 2 years. And after 2 years, if they still wanted to stay, then they could join. But he said it is the kind of thing that's very difficult to support when you've got other options available. You don't have to live that way. There have been times in history when people had to live that way. When Christians had to, in the first century, oftentimes had to live that way. They had no choice. They were minorities being persecuted. And to survive, they had to do that. We don't have to do that to survive. And without that kind of incentive, it's difficult to do that. I'm simply telling that story to illustrate the fact that this is a legitimate way in which Christians can express the life of Christ, can bring their costly wealth to the feet of Jesus, and do basically live what he taught. Other examples. I think we even in our midst, we have people in our community who are forgotten largely by larger society. Tony can tell you. Where's Tony?
Up there.
Tony can tell you a lot about that. We were blessed to have Eric and Denise Helfers introduce this class to the prison ministry. And as a result, a lot of us got involved with that. And that's where we met Tony. I'd met Tony long before he was incarcerated. But he will tell you, too, a prison is a place where Jesus basically advocated ministry. And it was because a prison is not a place where you find much love. Not much TLC up there, is there, Tony? It's a place where you are alone. It's a place where the dignity of humanity is pretty much trashed. And without contact with the outside, there are no spiritual, emotional, social lifelines. This is something very simple we can do. You can become involved in that ministry. You can go through the training to be a sponsor. You can take people who are incarcerated out on weekends and they've earned that pass. And that can make a huge difference in terms of their lives and in your life as well. A tangible way of putting boots on the ground and doing something for people who basically are poor indeed, not necessarily materially, but certainly materially as well as other ways as well. There was a woman who came to our church several years ago, and I'm searching for her name. I was asking Cece about it, and I cannot remember her name, unfortunately. I'm embarrassed I can't. She looked like a society model, a tall, statuesque blonde. Her husband was an executive, made a lot of money. She looked like she belonged in downtown Atlanta or Dallas. And she came to the Bible church, and we heard something about her reputation, where she had come from. She had a reputation of basically ministering to children. And she wasn't here more than a few weeks, and she was at Carrboro in some of the off-streets in Carrboro meeting kids. And before long, she had a Bible club going with the kids in Carrboro. These are kids in the poor district of Carrboro. And it grew. I said, how in the world did she get a reception? I mean, she doesn't look like she fits in Chapel Hill, let alone in the off-streets of Carrboro. But she did. The kids responded to her. And one of her incentives, because she had contacts with, for example, someone in this congregation who had an airplane, her incentive for the kids is if you memorize 100 verses, you get a ride in the airplane. And she worked that out, and these kids would knock themselves out for this. And they could get a flight in the plane, they'd fly around Chapel Hill and Durham and Raleigh and see where they lived, and things they'd never seen and probably wouldn't see before. The point is this. She put her feet on the ground, did something that, I don't know how much money she gave that cause and so forth. That wasn't the point. She got involved. I mean, she basically was face to face with people who had needs and used the opportunity she had because of wealth, because of her position and contacts, to leverage a ministry that showed dignity to people who ordinarily wouldn't have it. It's not so much the money. It's the dignity and respect. It's the showing up. What's important for us is to open our lives. If there's one ethical bottom line to dealing with poverty, it starts with this. Open your life to people who are not just like you or us. To people who have far less. Most of us are looking at people who have more than we do. And we want to interact with them. We aren't reaching out comfortably to people who have far less. That is step one in terms of ministering the way Jesus ministered. Next week, we're going to continue this and look at economic justice. This topic requires much more attention than just what I'm saying here. But I think it's got to start here. Now we have a chance to do the yes box. Yes?
I just looked up the figures, and $2.9 trillion are spent on social welfare in the United States, which amounts to 18% of GDP every year. Now, if you look at that on an annuity basis, that means that if you assume about 10% are poor, the equivalent wealth is about $300,000 for each poor person in the United States, which I think was his point when he was talking about the wealth equivalent of the social services that are given. It gives a different view of how wealth is distributed in the United States, because if you're giving a person on an annual basis $10,000, that's equivalent to an annuity that's fairly substantial.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think that's an interesting perspective. What I would say is, you know, how many of us will willingly join those ranks? So if I had to give up my wealth, which I consider in salary and assets and house and relationships and all the good stuff, if somebody said, give that up for a day and join the ranks such that I can be on social welfare and have the access to the annuity that you are talking about, I mean, I know for sure I don't want to be part of that. So I think, you know, a lot of people with material wealth talk about how social welfare costs money, and hence, you know, those people are wealthy. Well, how many of us want that wealth? Would be the true test of whether...
For the sake of the recording, say this, that the social welfare in this country is admirable with respect, in this respect, in terms of how much is made available to people who have material needs. The point I'm trying to make is that real addressing poverty the way Jesus did, it's not just a matter of giving money to poor people. It's a matter of restoring dignity to them. And in many respects, a welfare state takes away the dignity. It erodes the dignity. It doesn't empower people. It basically makes them dependent. And if anything, it causes them to feel inferior or needy, victims.
His biggest concern was spiritual poverty.
Right. But certainly the two go together.
They do.
They go together, yes.
Just from a personal experience, I was working with some kids from a very poor part of town, and I knew they were eligible for scholarships at a community college. And I called the president's office to ask how I could figure out how to apply and so forth. And he said, well, come over here, and the people here at the college will help you. So I brought them and their families along. We walked into the appropriate office, and the woman says, oh, we don't fill out applications for these kids. And the families that were with me turned around and started walking out. And I said, hold it, hold it. I called the president's office. He said, you do do this, and I want you to help them. And they ended up sitting down with them because they knew I was going to go up to the president's office. But what was interesting was these poor families who were with me heard, no, we don't do that. And they turned around and walked out. And had I not been there with them and with my big mouth yelling for some help, they would have gone home, and I'm not sure these kids ever would have gotten that taken care of. And by the way, they all got full scholarships and ended up attending that college. So there is this poverty spirit. When I saw them turn around and not fight to get what they were supposed to get.
Right. If there's nothing else that you come away from this class with today, it's this. I want you to understand that poverty is not just about money. It's about dignity, primarily. And a lot of the way in which our culture is addressing poverty is just to throw money at it. And again, there's a place for that. But Jesus did not come as basically a venture capitalist, materially. And what he did offer, as the disciples followed him, offered, silver and gold have we none, but what we have we'll give to you. And that is hope. That is a reason to live. A vision of what life is all about. And to the extent that our society reduces religion simply to social welfare and materialism, we are basically more Marxist than Christian in that view. And I think we've got to recognize that. And again, we fall into that. Because when we address poverty as Christians, we throw money at it. That's not what Jesus is calling us to. He's saying basically, get your boots on the ground. Learn to understand poor people. Develop relationships, eye-to-eye relationships with people who are needy. Not just poor materially, but certainly that as well. And develop a network where the church becomes a community of those who are known only as disciples of Christ, no matter how much money they have or what status they have in the community. That's what should characterize a church. And to the extent that we do that, we become authentic to the broader community.
Is that the reason why the government has so many social programs? Because the church has failed?
Well, I'm sure that's the reason that it's given, yes. And I think it's probably a good reason for that. I think the church is... We are fallen people like everybody else. And although it's hard to admit, we follow our culture more than our Christ. Yes, Joe.
Jim, I support what you're saying, but the one thing that challenges this, I think, is what I've read is, in those systems where there is a more proactive social welfare system, and you talk about, well, but you know, that diminishes the dignity of the individual. If you look at Europe, you know, my understanding is when they poll, you know, a lot of European societies, especially those that have, you know, more welfare, more socialist systems, that the contentment, the general happiness of that population is actually higher than it is in the States. And somehow that contradicts what you just said, I think.
Well, I think it's more complex than that. I hear what you're saying, and I agree with you. I think the happiest people in on the planet are in Denmark, from what sociologist tell us. Or Sweden. It's one of the Scandinavian countries. It's where I came from. I don't know how I wound up here. Going back. But I think the reason for that is that when you look at those cultures have a richness that is measured not just in material wealth. And I think that's something that underscores what I'm understanding this lesson to be about. And that is the fact that what contributes to a person's sense of dignity is not just having money. In America, we tend to reduce it to that. Yes.
Also, within these socialist systems, and having lived within the German socialist system for a long period of time, and knowing a lot of people who are financially secure, it doesn't lead to a happier.
Necessarily,
it leads to frustration. It leads to people who think very superficially and are very unhappy about many, many aspects of their lives.
Right. There are lots of stories I could tell, but our time is up. That would underscore what you said, Dorothy, in terms of the complexity of peace in a person's soul.
Okay, that's a good place to stop. Let this percolate next week and come back for part two of this lesson with your questions.